This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're spotlighting the people who prepare our meat before it reaches our plates. We hear from whole animal butchers, the brains behind a meat vending machine, California cattle ranchers, and a master of charcuterie who isn't using meat at all.
Like a smoked and grilled center stalk of the broccoli, and then it gets finished with some mustard, barbecue sauce, and sauerkraut.
Ranching and farming being as difficult as it is, you know, it's just one thing after another. And at some point, you just give up.
I had a wild idea that if I learned butchery, maybe I could start to be kind of a link in the supply chain.
Listen to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
And I'm your co-host, Valerie Lomas.
And we're just going to get right to it this week because we have an awesome guest, somebody we're both really excited to talk to. Not that we're not excited to talk to other guests, but this week in particular. I don't know. She's great. Tiffany Langston, writer and storyteller. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk with you.
So, Tiffany, tell us, what does it mean to be a writer and a storyteller? Who are you and what do you do?
I feel like I lead a double life. In my regular sort of 9-to-5 life, I am a marketing director for a nonprofit. I went to film school. I wanted to make movies. I wanted to be the first woman to win an Academy Award for directing. That has happened. It's not me. So I'm early failure. I've always really loved telling stories. And originally I started out doing that visually. And then a weird career pivot, I moved into the nonprofit sector. And now I'm telling different stories, but I'm telling really great stories about things that are awesome, things that are happening in the social sector. On the other hand, I also kind of dabble in food writing and food storytelling. And that has been a thing that I have always done on the side, but has really just recently become something that I've doing more frequently and with a little more notoriety. So that's been exciting.
So can you tell us about how it is that you pivoted into food writing specifically?
I have always been into food. I feel like everybody says that, but I grew up in a food household. My father was a baker, and both at a fancy hotel all the way to like industrial bread loaves baking. Dessert, it was always a thing in my household. My mother is a really great home cook. Food was really important to my family. And I worked in food service, but only for a little bit in my sort of teen years up through college. I like to consider myself sort of like food adjacent. I read a lot of food publications. I subscribe to a lot of food publications. And honestly, I got into it kind of a little bit by accident, or not really by accident. I never thought that I was good enough or that I could. One day I follow lots of food writers on Twitter and things like that. Helen Rosner at the time was an Eater, and she said, I need people to pitch me stories. And it doesn't matter if you're not like a published writer or things like that. I always thought that that was something that you needed to have in order to really make it in the food media. And she's like, if you have a good story to tell, like you can be a food writer. And that really stuck with me. So I ended up writing something specifically for a column at Eater. By the time that I got off my butt and actually did it, she had moved on to working at the New Yorker, but I still submitted it. And the person that I spoke with had really lovely complimentary things to say about it, but then said they didn't want it. And I pitched it a couple of other places. And then I said, well, I have a food blog. I have been more regular at times updating it than other times, but I'll put it up there and that'll be that. It was a really important story to me. I wrote about an incident that occurred or happened to me when I was working at Sonic Drive-In during the summer when I was in college. And it was a really important story to me. And I knew even after it happened, I thought, and this has been longer ago than I like to admit, I thought this would be an interesting story to tell one day. And so it was really nice to kind of get it on the proverbial paper and actually write it, even if something happened to it. Like, that was the goal, was to write the story. And then I ended up getting nominated for a James Beard Award for that story on my blog, at the time, I think the only people who read my blog were my husband and my mother. So that was really exciting for me. And that, I think that was sort of the entry point into doing more broader food writing.
Wow. What a splash. What a grand entry.
What was that? What did it feel, it's a stupid question, but what did it feel like to get nominated after having had trouble getting the piece placed? And how did the nomination happen? Somebody has to nominate you, right?
Yes. And that somebody was my husband, without me actually knowing about it. Amazing. So I just happened to, you know, be on Twitter for work, because I'm a communications person, and I get, you know, mentioned on Twitter. I thought, oh, somebody mentioned me on Twitter. And then I thought, wait a minute, what? So that was really exciting. And I know that that's rare. It's rare for people who are, you know, established food writers who've been in the industry for years and years and years to be someone who, you know, just came up, didn't even realize they were coming up. It was really exciting. I, you know, immediately called my mother. And I don't think I got a lick of work done that day because I was too busy being excited about it.
Yeah. And I love how you mentioned that, you know, Helen Rosner just put out a tweet and was like, hey, you know, food writing, it's really just storytelling. And if you have a story to tell, it's kind of like, obviously there are, you know, I don't know if gatekeepers is the right word, but in every industry, it's, you know, there's an entryway, so to say. And I think with food writing in particular, it is very much, doesn't feel open to most people. It doesn't feel like that entryway or that door is open. So how powerful that someone like Helen Rosner just went on Twitter and said, hey, the door can be open if this is something that, if you have a story inside of you that you need to tell or that you want to tell. How powerful that, you know, she gave, you know, that statement, and that it landed with you and with other people, I'm sure, as well.
Yeah, I mean, it did still take me months to write it, but I honestly, it was that, like, that 140, 280 characters right there that I thought, oh, maybe I really could. It gave me the confidence to try it, or to get started trying it, even if it took a long time. Yeah, absolutely.
What about the, I don't know, how did the nomination change the way that you approached food writing after the fact? Well, actually, you know what, before I ask that, we should take a step back and talk about the actual ceremony which you attended, right?
I did. I did, and it was cloud nine. I was really cool. I got to, Kathy Airway was at my table, Dan Passman was at my table. It was just really fun to kind of be in the, to be a part of it, and to see, so this is back in 2018, to see, you know, when they got to, when Padma got to the list of nominations, and to see my name at the top of there. There was something just really exciting about that. And the other nominees for my category, their pieces were phenomenal. And we're actually really, what's the really nice part is that we're really good friends now, right? Like, after the fact. And there's some kinship there. And I wasn't expecting to win. I was just like, you know how a lot of people are, it's just an honor to be nominated. Like, it really was just an honor to be nominated.
What was the winning, what was the category, and what was the winning entry?
Mm-hmm. So the category was personal essay, and the winning entry was by Lisa Donovan. And it was about, you know, kind of abuse in the food industry. And actually, I'm pretty sure that spurred the book that she wrote that just came out like a couple months ago. Wow. And it was called Dear Women, Own Your Stories. And it was in Food and Wine.
Wow. And so, Tiffany, what was it like after you got that nomination? Did you feel kind of empowered to pitch more publications? And if you did, What was that process like when you were able to start that email with, you know, James Beard nominated writer?
No, it was actually the exact opposite. I had severe like stage fright, writer's block. I was like, nobody used to pay attention to me, so it didn't matter what I wrote. And so then I was like, I can't write anything. Because at the time in which I wrote the story that I was nominated for, I said, this is probably one of the best things I have ever written in my entire life. And this is a person who writes a lot for work and other things. It won't ever be this good. And so I actually went probably an entire year or so without writing anything, like not on my blog, nothing. I was just like, I can't, like people are paying attention now. It's gotta be really good. So that actually took a bit to get over and a bit to kind of say like, no, like just get the ideas down on paper, because that original story started with me saying, just get the ideas down on paper. You can figure it out later. And I forgot that for about a year. I just forgot all about that. So I had the opposite problem. And yeah, so I published that piece originally in November of 2017. And then I didn't actually get a piece published by like in, you know, actual publication until this year. That's how long it took me to kind of get through it, because then I had an idea and then I wrote that and then I sat on it for months and then I finally said, okay, let me start, you know, finessing it, editing it, getting it into fighting shape. And then maybe someone will want 3,000 words on a topic that may only be important to me.
Do you think imposter syndrome kind of played a part?
Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah, I think it's, and I can almost kind of relate to this in a sense of like, okay, well, you had this amazing accomplishment. And so then like the standard that you set for yourself ends up being like this, you know, literally like can't get any higher standard. And yeah, like that can paralyze you because like the creative process needs that freedom to be and to exist and to have movement. And, you know, I think like when we kind of focus on like, oh, the final product like has to be like, you know, the top of our game, it's hard to get through that process to even get to a final product.
Oh yeah. I was afraid that I would pitch something and people would be like, oh, this, she's a hack, right? Like, how is she the person who got nominated for a Teen Award? She's a mess. Like, I was utterly afraid. I absolutely was like, it was a, you know, lightning striking once. It's never going to happen again. People are going to think I'm, you know, I don't have any talent, that I'm really bad at it. The other thing that was a little concerning was that, for the piece that I was nominated for, it was an event that happened to me and I was able to write about it. And I didn't have confidence in my ability to create a story in my mind and tell it. Because I think that's a lot harder, potentially. And so I thought, oh, I'm not good. I'm not good at storytelling. I'm not good at writing things that don't have to do with me. You know, I don't want to pitch an idea that I think is amazing and someone tell me it's stupid. So yeah, it was a lot to overcome that. And I would say, honestly, I'm still struggling with it, to be perfectly honest, but I'm getting better.
How did you work through that block, or what were some of the techniques that you found to help you start writing again?
Yeah. So the first thing, I am blessed to not have to, right? Like, I have a full 9-to-5 job that pays my bills. And if I don't ever write again, I'm afforded some leeway that most writers don't have, because they have to write, you know, they have to write, they have to pitch, they have to place in order to get paid. And so I am very fortunate, I guess, in a way that my livelihood didn't depend on it. And so I had the time to kind of work it out, which to me really was, you know, the next story that I had, the idea that I had for a story, started in 2018, actually. And I researched the story in the fall of 2018. I sat on it all of 2019 with just an outline. And then every month I would write a paragraph. I'd write, you know, a few sentences just so that it, like, keep it fresh in my mind. And I didn't actually finish it for a whole year, which is, you know, is a luxury a lot of people don't have in this industry.
But it also, I think it also creates this, that you're really writing from true passion, that you're not picking up stories to pay the bills, but you're writing about things that you want to be writing about in the way that you want to.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that that's the case. I honestly, I'm amazed at everybody, because now that I'm pitching and stuff, and then I'm seeing sort of what people are paying for freelance pieces and stuff, and I'm thinking, I don't know how people do this. On a regular basis can support themselves, because I find a lot of the rates to be, you know, everything from, you know, that's nice, but to utter jokes, like actual jokes. And, you know, so I also think that when it comes to me pitching, I really want the pieces that I write to go into publications that respect me as a writer and other writers too. I think that's important to me.
Yeah, I think you just touched on something that maybe we don't talk about enough, and that's what the rates are for writers, for freelance writers, how they have changed significantly over the past 10 years, 15 years, and how people in this industry, especially those of us who are freelancers, how we have to have so many different sources of income, because often, you know, freelance writing alone isn't quite enough to cobble together a livable income.
Yeah, I'm actually really excited at the end of the, because every year at the end of the year, a lot of writers will highlight some of the pieces that they wrote and then say, you know, this is where I placed it, this is how many words it was, this is how much I got paid. And I'm actually really excited to kind of participate in that this year, because I have at least a couple of pieces that are worth talking about. But I think transparency around that is super important. And I, you know, I find that also too in my regular 9-to-5 life. People don't get rich working at nonprofits, but there's, you know, a lot of people in the sector are underpaid. And then there's a lot of hiding of salaries and things like that. And I think that all of that is inequitable to, you know, people of color, to women, because it's oftentimes you'll find that you aren't getting paid as much as somebody else doing similar work. And I think that that is something that happens, I think, across the board in lots of different industries.
Are there ways that you've found to, talk about those issues or highlight those issues in either one of your two different works?
In my 9-to-5 working in nonprofits, one of the things that the last place that I worked, I was really adamant, because the organization said, oh, well, we are, you know, we're refocusing around equity. And I thought, well, yeah, but every time you post a job posting, you don't post a salary range. And it was a very hierarchical organization where every level had its own specific salary range. They existed. They just didn't want to put them. And I said, if you claim to be about equity, then this is something that you should do, because it is historically proven that women and people of color especially always undercut themselves in the salary negotiations. Because they, you know, they don't, they're all always historically underpaid. And so if they're thinking about, okay, I'm going to, when it says, you know, what's your desired salary, I'm going to name a number that's a little bit more than I'm making now versus what the job is valued to the new employer. It should have diddly squat to do with what you used to make, and have everything to do with how much that is valued by the person you're going to go work for. Go ahead.
Oh, no, finish your thought.
I was going to say in food media, I think I feel like it's a little bit different for people at my level, right? Like I don't have a ton of bylines yet. And so I think that it's sort of, this is the rate. And by following a lot of folks, I hear that you can, you know, ask for more potentially. I sometimes do, sometimes don't. It really kind of just depends on, you know, the value that I think about my time. But I think as I publish more, I will start to be more aggressive with negotiating that.
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. And I feel like, you know, you kind of challenging you know, this organization that claims to be about equity, about posting salary ranges, like it's something that's so simple, but it's so huge. And like you said, like this isn't like specific to any industry. Like these are not industry specific problems. These are like societal issues that show up in every industry. So it's obviously, it's like the same thing within our industry of food media. You know, you just don't see different publications or different websites really sharing in any kind of transparent way, you know, what they pay other people. And I think like what you said about contributing to some type of online database where like we are sharing that information is definitely a step. It's just, I don't know, it's just something to think about how we've kind of shifted that burden to the freelance writers or to the staff writers or editors, opposed to the actual companies and organizations.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely was paying attention to some of the things that were happening around Bon Appetit, right? And so you have a lot of allegations that nobody is really disputing about certain people on that staff not being paid what others are being paid, you know, and you have Sola coming out and saying, yeah, this is what I came on to make. And here are other people over here making a lot more, or, you know, and so when honestly, at the point in time in which there was a shakeup at the top, I would have loved to have seen Bon Appetit be very like open and transparent about what the editor-in-chief was making to ensure that the new editor-in-chief would be making something similar or more. And, you know, there was a lot of speculation, but I think it would have been a really great move for them to have said so.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And I mean, I think they did months and kind of say, oh, we have this new standardized video rate of $1,000 a video, which, you know, apparently we saw what happened when that was offered to the staff of color who worked on the video team. They all quit en masse because, you know, they knew what the other people were making who were creating video content. So this whole, like, this is going to be our rate going forward for people who don't have contracts yet wasn't quite good enough. But that's really a great point about us being able to see it like top to bottom, like the whole spectrum of like knowing what's out there, what's possible, and so that we can all kind of properly value our own work.
Absolutely.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
And we're back. You're listening to Why Food, and our guest this week is Tiffany Langston, writer and storyteller. Tiffany, at the top of the interview, you were telling us a little bit about your James Beard Award nomination. The James Beard Awards have been through a little bit of a mess this season. Would you just give us a quick update on what's been going on for any listeners who might not be aware and
sure.
Share your
so
thoughts on
there
the whole situation?
Was so the they had the media awards earlier this year, and they had originally planned to have the restaurant awards in person. They moved to September, then they kind of canceled them. The claims are that they canceled them after the voting had already taken place because reasons abound. But some folks say it's because there were no Black winners in all of the categories, even though there were numerous, finalists. And that not only were they canceling, there's still going to be a ceremony of sorts, but it was really going to be a celebration of the restaurant industry, but there were going to be no awards. You have an entire year almost where people, well, not a year, half a year at least, where people were nominated, then they were finalists, and then they get kind of no either validation or anything like that. And then they also canceled them for next year as well. And there have been I've seen a lot of things about sort of what's wrong with it, right? Like who's invited to vote, who's not invited to vote, who are on the different committees and things like that. I feel like I have a very interesting relationship with the James Beard Awards because I truly and honestly believe that if it weren't for my nomination, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you today. So I am grateful for a lot of things having to do with that and the doors that it opened, the folks that I got to meet, the networking that I've been able to do because of it. But I also don't think that that should be something that should be, I shouldn't be, you know, the exception to the rule, right? I think that there are tons of wonderful writers. And I mean, and I will say that the James Beard Awards cancellation was specifically had to do with the restaurant awards and chef awards. But I think there is some, you know, there are some parallels to the media awards because it also looked very monochromatic for a really long time. And I think just within the last couple of years, were they starting to really kind of look sort of beyond the same old people who always got nominated. And it was nice to be kind of in it. If there was any little part that I played, that's really nice to know. So on the one hand, I'm very grateful to have been nominated because it has opened up a lot of doors for me and given me a lot of opportunities. The doors and opportunities, I think that should be available, more widely available. But I also agree that there are a lot of issues and things that they need to work through. I don't know if I'm qualified to talk about whether or not I think the awards this year should have been canceled. On the one hand, I feel for a lot of the restaurants that could have really used that boost. On the other hand, if it is true that the reason why it was canceled was because there is an issue with how voting goes down in a way that undercuts, you know, Black chefs, Black restaurateurs, and other, you know, chefs of color, then I think that they need to look at that, and there needs to be some real tearing down of how those awards are voted on.
It also came out recently, I mean, just to add to the mess, it came out recently that they then informed some of the winners that they had won, but told them that they weren't going to get awards or weren't going to be publicly named, but that they could tell people that they had been, that they had won. Am I remembering that correctly? There was this like extra addition to the train wreck that they had already created with all of the mixed messaging.
I didn't hear that, Ethan, but if you have any names to name.
Well, I think Pete Wells has written, I think two columns in, or two articles in the New York Times about it. Just about what a mess it is.
Yeah. I definitely read the first one that he wrote. And this is all very much hearsay, but from what I've read about the situation, I think it wasn't just an issue of the winners potentially not really being representative of the industry, but it was also perhaps an issue of the winners not being representative of what our ideals are for our industry. I think the restaurant industry in recent years, from the Me Too movement to this idea of how it is that we treat people who work in the restaurant industry when it comes to things like paid sick leave, when it comes to things like a safe work environment, all of that stuff. I think that the ideal and the goal is we are recognizing people who obviously create amazing food, but are also really good stewards of the community. And I think I think if we do have to hit a pause button and take a closer look, I think that's going to ultimately be a positive thing. Just when we think about like the future of restaurants, essentially, because I mean, the future of restaurants in and of itself is really hanging in the balance right now with struggling during this time of massive closures and massive uncertainty about what the future is going to look like when it comes to regulations, when it comes to are people comfortable enough to actually be dining out at restaurants to the extent that's needed for a restaurant to sustain itself without some kind of massive government intervention. So if ultimately what we want is our awards that are going to recognize kind of like the whole entity opposed to like, you know, just a chef creating delicious food. You look at something like what happened with Squirrel in Los Angeles. I think, you know, people were like, the food was good. The toast and jam and ricotta was good. But if you're not, if you don't have good business practices, what good is it if the food
itself is good? Yeah, and for that one, that incident especially, they were also talking about, you know, who gets the credit, right? Because one of the things about Squirrel was that they said, oh, well, you know, she was the person who got kind of all of the accolades and all of the awards and things like that. But really, you know, there were allegations that she's not, she doesn't cook that much. She's not in the restaurant that often. You know, it's the sous chefs and the line cooks and stuff who are really coming up with the ideas and the recipes that when, especially in these awards, you know, they don't give the award to the restaurant. They give the award to the executive chef, like the big name. And, you know, there are questions, or I think potentially a conversation that could be had about how those are laid out as well.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. And also, I think the issue, you know, extends beyond awards. This idea of who's getting quote unquote credit. You know, often, you know, a lot of these very popular restaurants or chefs, they put out cookbooks of their most popular things. So yeah, it's definitely a question of, you know, how can, like, just how, like, with whatever little power people within our industry do have, and the James Beard Foundation is rather powerful, how can we all each use our little corner of influence to try to make things a little bit better? And I think if we kind of look at it from that angle, with what's happening with the James Beard Awards, I think it's a little bit easier to digest the natural feelings of unfairness for the specific chefs who, you know, who weren't able to kind of have their moment.
Yeah, and I think I'll add one more thing about the James Beard Awards from a kind of a different, or James Beard Foundation from a sort of different angle. Before I moved to New York in 2014, I lived in Memphis and I worked at the Memphis Convention and Visitors Bureau. And my entire job was to promote Memphis as a food destination. And as part of that, I mean, like my job, I was chasing these awards. I was chasing these awards for the chefs in my city, doing whatever I could. I actually helped organize a dinner at the James Beard House with Memphis chefs. And I was amazed at like how much it cost, how much it cost for the chefs, how much it cost, you know, as our organization had tried to help defray some of those costs. But there's a very privileged few who have the resources, the staff, the money to be able to fly to New York to put on a dinner, pay for all the costs of you know, putting that on to hopefully get in front of the eyes of the people who eventually may one day get to the point where they, you know, they can get one of these awards. And it's been an interesting kind of journey for me as a person coming from that end to through, you know, the writing and stuff on the other side to kind of really thinking about what, who gets the ability to, you know, receive these awards and these accolades if you don't have the money or the resources to really chase them.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a very good point. And that definitely extends from restaurants to the journalism awards as well, because you know, we talked about how a lot of these publications aren't necessarily paying rates that would enable you as a freelance journalist, right, to be able to self-nominate your stuff and pay those entry fees. So I think that's a very good point about like the cost of entry and what that looks like. And outside of the New York region, right? That's a whole nother different thing. Cause there is very much within our industry, as you mentioned, it's you know, there are the people who are known and the people who are lesser known or not yet known. And it would be really nice to see how we can make sure that you know, you're that, you know, it's not a quote unquote, you know, popularity contest.
Read about an author who was beating herself up because she was like, I don't know why I nominated myself. I didn't have the money. She had to submit several hardback copies of this book that she had just gotten published. She had to pay to ship it. She had to pay the entry fee. And she was like, I really needed to sell those so that I can make money. You know, so I agree with you in the idea of broadening the scope of who and making it more accessible for people.
Right, absolutely. And even publishing a cookbook, like there are so many things about our industry, I'm like, this is not for poor people. Like there have been so many moments where I'm like, like my goodness, like if you can't self-finance part of this, whether it's like, you know, whether it's freelance writing where you're essentially kind of having to subsidize the hours that you're putting in, whether it's writing a cookbook, even if you get a good deal, it's still like, I mean, you start doing the math and you look at the hours that you're putting in and the uncertainty of what lies on the other side of that book coming out. You know, this is definitely an industry where, you know, if you have some level of privilege, it's going to help you get through a lot of those moments where otherwise it would be hard for things to financially make sense.
Yeah, I remember Alison Robicelli had another beautiful Twitter thread a while ago about someone who had approached her to write a book about, I think, some of the top places to eat in Washington, D.C. or something. And I think she was supposed to like profile 50 of them or 100 of them or something, but they weren't going to pay her any money. And she was supposed to like help finance the launch party. And then she would get like some percentage of the sales on the back end. And, you know, that this particular company had several people who had done exactly that. This was not the first book that they had published. But, you know, there are a lot of folks who want people to write for pennies or write for free. And like you said, like, how do you do it if you're not independently wealthy, if you don't have other streams of income? Because, yeah, that I had always believed I need to have at least just one kind of published piece, and then I can use that to pitch other pieces. And so the fact that my first published piece was on my blog, I said, oh, this doesn't count, right? This doesn't count because it hasn't been published in, like, you know, a top tier publication. I need that in order to be successful here. I don't necessarily think that's the case anymore, or maybe it's changing slowly, but that's what I always thought. And so there are people who are willing to do the work for free or for very, very low pay because they think it's going to give them a foothold into like additional opportunities. And sometimes that happens, but a lot of times it doesn't.
I want to make sure we leave time for our fun question segment. But I don't know, what do you think is going to happen? What's going to come out of this? The industry obviously has to change. Food media as an industry obviously has to change, but it's very intertwined with food as an industry and restaurants in particular. So where do you see this going? How do you see it changing over the next few years?
I usually am super optimistic, but I'm going to say it probably is going to get worse before it gets better. And I say that because a lot of publications, you know, rest on ad dollars in order to be able to pay for things. And not just the restaurant industry, but like retail. Like a lot of industries are really, really struggling right now, which means that there are a lot of, you know, folks who aren't buying ads. I read an article. There's a big clothing retailer in New York City that filed for bankruptcy. And I think there was in that article, it said that there were currently 1,100 lawsuits happening around the country with retailers whose insurance isn't covering the interruption in business. And so a lot of people are going out of business. And so I think that it's going to be for all traditional publications, I think there's going to be tightening. There's going to be either fewer pieces or fewer pieces available because they'll be going to staff people that they don't have to pay, you know, additional for that, or, you know, less ads and things like that. And I think from the ashes, I don't say it's going to all burn down, but like, I'm hoping that there will be a more equitable food media industry. And there are people who are doing the good work there. Alicia Kennedy is one that initially comes to mind. There was a wonderful Eater article a couple days ago with Davina Davidson. I think there are people who are like thinking about it and doing the work, but I think it's gonna probably burn a little bit more before there's a rebirth, a renaissance.
Yeah, that's not so pessimistic. I feel pretty similarly. And it's hopefully will be reborn better than it ever has been.
I'm sure. Let's go with that.
Optimistic, right?
I think that's an optimistic outlook.
Let's do some rapid fire, shall we, Vari?
Let's do it.
You want to start?
Favorite
gourd?
Oh my gosh!
Oh, good one.
Probably butternut squash.
Why?
This is going to sound really classic, funny, but I really, they're so tough to get into that I have to take out like my biggest knife and like whack at it, and it helps me like release my aggression.
That's a great answer. What's your favorite fall, like classic fall dish, something that you look forward to all year to eat?
That's a really great question. I really love when apples roll around kind of around this time. And there was a woman when I was growing up in my church who made a delightful like apple cake. And we would have cake walks during like fall carnivals and things. And she would always make one. And I didn't do cake walk except for when that cake came up because I really wanted that cake. Okay. So
what's a cake walk?
Ethan, what's a cakewalk? What were you doing in your childhood?
I was being a child in New York City where we didn't have any cakewalks. I've never even heard of
it. It's a fundraising activity that a lot of times churches or PTAs or schools will do, where the congregation or the parents or stuff will provide cakes, baked goods, you know, cupcakes, whatever. And depending, you know, and so the prizes were donated. And then you would pay for an entry into the cakewalk, maybe a ticket or a dollar or something. And then you would basically play musical chairs. And then they would draw like a number. And if you were in the number of chair that was selected, you got to get the cake. You won the cake. It is fun.
Oh, wow. Cool. That sounds like fun.
Yeah. We would do it at the fall fair in elementary school. And it was crazy because it was like one little walk around and then you win a whole cake. And as like a small child, a whole cake is that's a lot of prize.
Do people usually share the cake with their friends, or is it like this is my cake, I want it?
Are you talking about me specifically? Kind of
I don't know. In general, I'm just curious about this this event in
this concept of a cakewalk.
Yeah, musical chairs meets cake meets baseball.
Yeah.
I love it.
Generally,
I think you take the cake home.
Okay, that makes sense.
I didn't realize we didn't have cakewalks in New York City. Yeah, that's awesome.
Tiffany, what is the one kitchen utensil you can't live without?
I You said utensil and not appliance, because I have two different answers. Utensil, probably citrus reamer. I've been really trying to, I've been juicing a lot of lemons and limes lately. I made a lot of lemonade during COVID. It's not something I used to do. But one day I was just like, I would really like to have some lemonade. And then every 3 or 4 days, I would just make a new batch of lemonade. So yeah.
That's my KitchenAid sand mixer,
100%.
And what about appliance?
I feel like that's probably not like a unique answer, though.
No, actually, I mean, usually we talk about like kitchen tool. Probably the most common answer we get is a chef's knife, but KitchenAid sand mixer is a, if you had to pick one thing to take with you to a desert island that had electricity.
I've been making a lot of pasta. I got the pasta roller and a couple of pasta cutter attachments for my birthday this year. And I decided that while I was quarantined, I was going to really work on making pasta. And I have been making it probably on average once a week for the last 3 months. And I have not tried to roll it by hand, but I hear it's a lot of work, and that attachment to my KitchenAid sand mixer makes it so that I wouldn't just do it once a year. Like, it's easy for me to do it once a week because it takes a lot of the hard work out of it.
And speaking of your fresh pasta habit, I also really, just seeing your pictures on social, I really appreciate
my
your pasta drying device. The umbrella, yeah. What is that called?
It's a pasta drying rack. Actually, the first pasta that I tried during quarantine, I hung on plastic hangers. I washed a bunch of hangers. I didn't have a drying rack, and I said, "Oh, I need to buy something that will allow me to dry this pasta." And so I purchased something on, you know, that type that shall not be named, that gets me free delivery. But it's a plastic like stand that has these little like spokes sticking out of it, and I call it I think it looks like a space tower or something. And then when you hang the pasta over it, it does look very impressive.
Yeah, it really does. Speaking of social, where can our listeners find you, read your work, see your pictures?
Recipes, I am at Tiff Langston, TiffLangston. On all of the socials that I'm on. I have a website, tiffanylangston.com. From there, you can also find my blog, which is tiffanytaste.com. I will update it sometime really soon, I promise.
And did you see that a new story?
I had a story that came out in Food and Wine in July, one in Garden and Gun in August. I have one coming up I'm not allowed to talk about yet, but by the end of the year.
Awesome. And as always, you can reach us by email, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org, on social at yfoodpodcast. You can reach me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram.
And you can find me on social media at Foodie in New York.
Thanks to Jess Kranjic, our sound engineer. Amazing as always. Thanks to the Red Crickets for our theme song, Blind. And most of all, Tiffany, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you
so
much for having me.
Wonderful conversation and great to catch up. See you all next week.
See you next week. Bye.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.